Among other questions, if you could ask God one question, what would it be? And the number one response to that question that people would like to ask God is, why is there suffering in the world? That question is as old as the first human tear, and it is as current as the most recent news broadcast. Why is there suffering in the world? If God is all-powerful and all-loving, then why do people hurt? A follow-up question that we might ask of that, for a Bible believer, for someone who understands something about what the Scriptures say about suffering, we might understand that sin has its consequences. We might understand that there is suffering in the world because sin entered into the world in Genesis 3. But here's a question that many Christians ask. Why do God's children suffer sorrow, heartache, pain, and difficulty? That was Job's question. He was a righteous man. There was no hidden sin in his life. And God Himself said he's an upright and perfect man in his generation. And yet he suffered, and that was his question. Why am I suffering if I am lived right? That was David's question in Psalm 73. His feet had well nigh slipped because the righteous were suffering and the wicked were prospering. That's a question that has been asked by the righteous in every generation, and perhaps it is your question or has been your question. Why do God's children have to suffer? We have been studying from Hebrews 12 in our Vacation Bible School for the last few days. We studied verses 1 through 3. I thought it might be appropriate just to pick up in that study in the next section of Hebrews 12, so be turning there if you will. And we will begin reading in verse 3 because that's the beginning of the paragraph, but our focus will be on verses 5 through 12. Jesus was not like some other religious teachers who have just tried to dodge the question of suffering by saying that suffering's only an illusion. It's not real. No, Jesus said, "In this world you shall suffer tribulation," John 16, 33. Another version has on that, "In this world you will suffer." So Jesus didn't dodge the question. He owned it and said to us, you can expect it. And in fact, in that context, He's saying to His disciples, you will even experience suffering because you are a follower of Christ that others won't suffer. You'll be persecuted for your faith. And so we see that suffering is not just for those who disavow God and His Word, but also, and sometimes because of, faith in Jesus. Now let's read this section. I'll make some comments as we go through just to help draw out certain ideas, and then we will look at a discussion of the main thought of the passage. Let's begin in verse 3. "For consider Him that endured such contradiction of sinners against Himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds." Now, the larger context of the book of Hebrews, of course, is that there were Christians who were being persecuted, what we might call mild to moderate persecution. He's going to say in this context, you have not yet resisted unto blood. So they had not yet faced physical persecution or martyrdom, but they were facing social and economic persecution. Those are the first two areas that a society generally asserts its disapproval of Christians in. That is, they are identified, rejected, and ostracized, made the butt of jokes, and made their blame for certain views that they take. And then the second one is economic. In this case, they had suffered the confiscation of their goods or the spoiling of their homes. So they had already had some come in because they were Christians take advantage of them. In more modern context, it generally takes the form of penalties and fines. If you teach this, if you hold this, then we're going to take away your tax-exempt status, or we're going to slap this fine on you for violating this code or this law. So we see that Satan really hasn't changed much. And then we're going to see later that the persecution can escalate to physical persecution, stripes and imprisonments and even martyrdom. In this case, some of them were thinking about leaving Christ and going back to Judaism. They're saying, you know, we were Jews before we became Christians, and Jews didn't have to suffer like this. I think I'm going to go back and be a Jew again. And Paul, if he be the writer of Hebrews, which seems most likely, says to them, you can't go back. There's no salvation in Judaism since Christ has replaced that law, and everything about Christianity is better than Judaism anyway. And better is one of the key, is the key word of the book. How he shows that Christ is better than Moses and the New Testament is better than the Old Covenant and so forth as you go through the book. So, writing in that larger context of Christians that were thinking about quitting because of persecution, we're suffering, it's not worth it, he writes to them, consider Jesus. Jesus was the most righteous man who ever lived, the only sinless one, and he suffered contradiction of sinners against himself, the opposition of his enemies, and how they arrested him, they slandered him, they beat him, they ultimately killed him. So when you became a Christian, you were following one who suffered, and therefore it is to be expected that those who follow him may have to go down that same path. That's what verse 3 means. So don't be wearied and faint in your mind. Don't let that knock you off your course just because others disapprove or hurt you. Verse 4, ye have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. You haven't yet had to bleed for your faith. Now, the striving against sin, sin is the enemy of both God and man. It's the one thing that can destroy your life eternally. Now, there are some things that the world may be able to do to destroy life here for us, destroy our comfort, but they cannot touch our souls. They cannot touch what is truly valuable. Matthew 10:28, don't fear those that kill the body, but fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. That's the great fear. And sin is the one thing that will send a person to hell and that we must be rid of in order to go to heaven. So we must strive against sin. That's strive against personal sin, strive against sin in our families, and to the degree that we have influence, to strive against sin in our society. We must be a voice crying in the wilderness, if that's what it takes, that this behavior God does not approve. This action is not what we ought to be doing. So we need to cry out against sin, striving against sin. Now verse 5, and ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children. He reminds them that this is not a new doctrine. Proverbs 3:11-12 has been in the Hebrew Bible all the way since the days of Solomon. Almost 1,000 years before Christ came, it was written in the Bible, and it had been available, and they had no doubt learned it and memorized it. So Paul quotes it here and says, you've forgotten what the Old Testament said. It's still true. Which speaketh unto you as unto children. The word child, son, sons, and children will be used 6 times in these next 3 verses. That's the key idea, the key concept here. And what he's doing is showing that we have a God in heaven, but that God is not just a sovereign king, he's also a loving father. And that's the emphasis here. We are not only soldiers in his army, we're not only citizens in his kingdom, but we are also children in his family. Now watch this. Speaketh unto you as unto children, my son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. You notice how persecution is now changed from something that is exerted on Christians from the world, from their enemies, and now is said to be from God. Not that God causes it, not that God desires it, but when it comes, God uses it. And it's a part of His discipline. It's a part of His training regimen for Christians. The word chastisement or chastening here is a Greek word for a Greek concept. When they reared their children in the Greek culture, part of that training regimen until they reached their maturity was to go to the gym every day and to work out the body. And so that was not a pleasant experience necessarily. Sweat, soreness, exertion, tired. Well, you've been to the gym. You've played sports, and so you know that although there are exciting and enjoyable parts of it, there it's not an easy thing. So he's saying here, God is working us out by our difficulties. He's training us. He is making us more fit spiritually because of the difficulties that we have to go through, which, among other things, would include persecution. For whom the Lord loveth, verse 6, He chasteneth. The devil wants us to feel like God doesn't love us when we hurt, but the opposite is true. Whom the Lord loves, He chastens. So that's a sign of God's love, because love brings out the best in us, and that's what God's trying to do. And scourgeth every son whom He receiveth. If you endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? But if ye be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are you bastards or illegitimate and not sons. In other words, if we don't suffer or we don't have this discipline, well, let me back up and say it this way. How poor is a child who doesn't have parents to train him, who doesn't have a father to discipline him, who does not have someone who's looking out for his best interest or her best interest as he or she grows up? Now, sometimes that may have to be a surrogate in our society where homes break down sometimes. But how sad it is for a child to grow up undisciplined. And are they ever going to be able to reach their potential? No. They may very well suffer greatly later because of that. Well, what about a spiritual child? Has God left us spiritual orphans that don't have anybody to train us? Who do not have anybody to look out for our advancement? No. God would be a poor father if that were the case. So God Himself takes on that responsibility for every Christian. He says, I'm going to rear them up. I'm going to help them to be disciplined. I'm going to help them to learn to reach their potential. And instead of seeing suffering in the light of only the temporary discomfort that it brings, we see it in the larger context of, well, this is like going to the gym. This is like being sore after a workout. It's worth it because I know I'm going to benefit from it. God is helping me to be more pure and more dedicated to Him because of the experiences that I go through. Verse 9, furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence or respect. Shall we not much rather be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? Our earthly parents are responsible for our bodies. That is, we have their genes, but they are not responsible for our souls. The Father of spirits is God. And our fathers on earth, we gave them respect because they deserved it, because God said to do it, because we feared their discipline. So we also must give God respect, and more so because our earthly parents were imperfect. That's the next verse. For they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure, that is, according to their own judgment. But was that judgment always perfect? No. And we as parents sometimes have to say to our children, it's like, you know, I was wrong. I should not have said that. Or I punished you for something that I later found out you were not guilty of. Or I over-punished you for an infraction that I previously had not punished you at all for. See, we're not always consistent. But God is a perfect Father who always knows what to do and does the right thing. But He, for our profit. Sometimes our parents may have punished or disciplined us according to what made them feel better. God never does that. God instead always does what's in the best interest of the recipient, that we might be partakers of His holiness. Now, no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. I mean, who would choose to be persecuted? Who would choose to go through difficulties? Nobody. But when we have to go through them, then ultimately, we, on the other side of it, in the bigger picture, it can bring joy. It can later looked back on and say, I would not have chosen to go through that, but I'm glad that I did. Nevertheless, afterward, it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. You see that concept of exercising that we saw earlier in the word that was used? You see it here again. Whereby lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees. So that's the section that we would like to study. And we're just going to ask three questions. I don't know if we'll get past the first one in this class or not. I think we will at least get the first one. We may do the other two tonight, but we'll see how it goes. Let's ask this question. I don't know that I've ever taught a full lesson on God's discipline before, so I've enjoyed this study, and maybe it will be something that will be of benefit to you. So we're just going to approach it with a very simple outline. Why, number one, does God chasten His children? Why? We touched on that a little bit in the discussion of those verses, but now let's explore it a little more. First, God does not do so because it pleases Him. He does not do so because He gets some sadistic pleasure by seeing His children have to hurt. No, you could put down Lamentations 3:31-33, when God punished Israel and their city was burnt, Jerusalem was burned down, and they were carried away into captivity. The book of Lamentations is the funeral, Jeremiah's funeral sermon for the city. And he acknowledges in that God did not enjoy bringing grief on them, but it was because of their sin. They had to learn from that, and then they could come back when they had learned their lesson. Also, Revelation 3:19 says, as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Not as many as I hate, but as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. So you see again that that's because God loves us, not because He's angry with us. Perhaps the best single verse to show why God chastens us is Genesis 50, verse 20. All the way back to the Old Testament, last chapter of Genesis. And you may remember that the book of Genesis, the second half of it, is divided among those great patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Beginning in chapter 37 through the end of the book, 13 chapters, you have a discussion of the life of Joseph. Most of us are familiar with Joseph's life. Joseph was hated by his brothers. You remember that they envied him. Eventually, they kidnapped him and were going to murder him, but they decided instead to sell him into slavery. He ended up down into Egypt, just a teenager. He was sold into the hands of Potiphar. He was a slave there. Potiphar's wife eventually desired to send with Joseph. Joseph refused, and Potiphar was angry with Joseph, and he threw him in prison. So here, Joseph, who was a righteous young man, has gone through unfair persecution against him, and it's just landed him in more and more trouble all along. Now, later, God had him in the right place for his brothers when the famine came to find sustenance and to keep the family alive during this terrible consecutive years of famine. Anyway, after Jacob died, the brothers were afraid that he would retaliate against them, and so they came to him, concocted a story, and he says all that to build up to Genesis 50, verse 20, where he had reasoned out this way, "But as for you brothers, ye meant it for evil." I mean, there was no goodwill in your heart when you took me, stole my coat of many colors, threw me in a cistern and sold me as a slave. You did not mean me any good. Ye meant it for evil. But God meant it for good, to save much people alive. That's the desire of God for all of the discipline of His children. He means it for good. Now, it may be at the hands of someone who means it for evil. I mean, in the case of these Hebrew Christians, whoever it was that were confiscating their goods, whoever it was that was ostracizing them, and later that might lead them into prison, they didn't mean any good to the Christians, but God meant it for good. He allowed that to happen so that the lessons might be gained. All right. Chastening is for two purposes. Why does God allow chastening? Two primary reasons. Number one, God allows discipline, or God disciplines His children for education. There is no university like trial and sorrow. You will learn more under those circumstances than in any other single stage or section of life. Now, you may have a high school diploma. You might have a vocational school certificate. You may have a college or university degree or multiple degrees. We have different educational backgrounds represented in this room. But I guarantee you there's one that all of us have reached many summers, as the Indians would say. We all have a diploma from the University of Hard Knocks. I mean, you don't get out of this world without difficulty, without bruises, without challenges to your faith. And in that school, we will learn lessons that we couldn't learn in high school. We couldn't learn in vocational school. We couldn't learn in any university. The children of Israel, when they were brought out of Egypt on the way to Canaan, went to school in what we might call the wilderness school. It ended up because of their sin. They were there for 40 years. And they were a different people, not only literally because the older generation had died off, but also they were a different people in the sense that they were not the slaves that they had been down in Egypt. Now, they were hardened by this wilderness wandering. They had learned to, again, respect the will of God so that when they went in to conquer Canaan, they were prepared to inhabit those cities and to make of themselves a nation. God had educated them by difficulty, sorrow, and trial. It's interesting when you think about the context here in Hebrews of persecution against Christians being used by God and those two different entities coming from different perspectives. Men may persecute us because we are religious, but God uses the same persecution to make us more religious. You see how the devil loses in that? Men may try to get us to give up our profession. God uses the same events to test the authenticity of our profession. These trials can bring about not the desired end of the ones who are bringing them upon us, but can be used by God to accomplish what He sees is best for us. And none of us could say that we are beyond the need for training, that we've lived long enough, we don't need any more discipline as from God. Well, who could say that? The only person who could ever have said that was Jesus Christ. And even He learned by the things which He suffered, Hebrews 5:7, that His faith was tested as ours will be. God uses suffering to teach us four things. It's still under the education point. Number one, to teach us correction. That's Hebrews 12:9. Our fathers corrected us. God corrects us. How poor a father we would be if we watched a child do something we know was dangerous to him, was antisocial behavior, that if he continued along that path would ruin his life and we just let it go. Well, what would that say about God who let His son or daughter sin and go into a path that was dangerous to him or her? And not do anything about it. You see, discipline has the one aspect of correction. Number two, and these are the first three are all from the context that we read. That's Hebrews 12:9. Hebrews 12:10 says that chastening is for the purpose of making us partakers of God's holiness. It helps us to separate this world from the next world, to be more dedicated, which is what the word holy means, to be sanctified. It makes us more dedicated to God and more like God in character. Number three, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness. That's in verse 11. The two ideas there, righteousness is fairly close in meaning to holiness in the previous verse. It just means right living as defined by God. But the other idea there is of peaceable fruit of righteousness. So he has in mind bringing about peace to our lives, which seems the opposite of what would come from the turmoil of persecution. And also He wants us to learn to have peace with ourselves because we have peace with Him, and then peace within our circle, our families, our friends. But then as much as life in us, peace with all men, Romans chapter 12. So that's one of the results, or one of the things to learn in persecution is to learn peaceableness. And then number four, and this is from another context, 1 Corinthians 11:32, which we'll look at later. It has the purpose of helping us not be condemned with the world. Not being condemned with the world. Talk about that more later, but it belongs in your notes at this point. So four things God hopes to teach us in chastening or in suffering correction, partakers of holiness, peaceable fruit of righteousness, and help us not be condemned with the world. Now, we said that there are two purposes, two primary purposes to God's discipline. One is education. The other is experience. Education, experience. If you were hoping to get a new job, you filled out your resume, or maybe you're filling out some forms before an interview process, the first thing that you would likely do is put down all of your educational experience. Well, I have this degree, I've taken these classes, I have this background academically. Another thing that you would do, and they would ask for, is, well, what experience do you have? Have you worked a similar job? Let's take two candidates for the same position. One has just finished his degree. Another has been out for a few years working in a similar job in another company. Both of them are applying for the position. All things being equal, which one's going to get hired? Most likely the one with the experience, because there are some things that you can't learn in a book. There's some things that you're going to learn, you're going to take from the book and learn how to apply it in a real-life situation to accomplish a certain production goal. So, experience. Same thing is true. You know, here, suffering is to teach us these certain lessons. Well, that's good to learn those lessons. But there are some things that God is going to need us to do that we need to learn, we need to have experience in order to be qualified to do. All right, I'm going to say this a different way. I can get in that glassy look like, what does that mean? Let me just illustrate it this way. Let's say that God sees in the future, be it a month, a year, or 10 years from now, He's going to need somebody to accomplish a certain thing for Him. He sees in His infinite wisdom that there's nobody right now prepared to be that person. Is it possible that God might look around today and say, okay, this is the person I'm going to need to do this job, but He's not ready to do it yet. He needs to have some experience before He'll be qualified to do that job. And then, in God's infinite wisdom, bring into our lives the things that will teach us, give us the experience that later we will be able to use to accomplish the good purpose that He needs us to do. You could use Joseph as an example of that. We just went through his story, so I don't need to go back through much of it. But may I just remind you that God could see this famine coming, 14 years of famine, and His people are going to be hungry. Egypt was going to have... Now, we don't know why God chose for that famine to be there and not in Egypt, but that's the way it was. So, He put Joseph where He needed him, but that started 20 years before, where eventually Joseph went through all that and then was promoted and became next in line to the king, so that when his brothers came, they came into his presence. He knew them, recognized them, and provided for them. God put him where He needed him 20 years in advance. Well, look over to 2 Corinthians. I'll show it to you in a different context. Chapter 1, verses 3 through 5. 2 Corinthians 1:3, blessed be God, even the Father, our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies. I know you're still turning, but I wanted to get to the last part of the verse. The God of all comfort. Everybody with me now? Let's read verse 4. Who comforteth us in all our tribulation. That's what we're talking about, isn't it? We hurt. God, I'm hurting. He's not disinterested in that. He comforts us in that. That we may, now watch this next part, be able to comfort them which are in any trouble by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. You see what He's saying? Today I'm hurting, God. I've gone through whatever experience it is. It's a tribulation. Maybe it's grief over a loss. Maybe it's persecution, perhaps it's the loss of a job, some relationship difficulty that's keeping me awake at night and breaking my heart. God, why am I having to go through this? Help me get through this. Comfort me. So we go through that period of time. Maybe it's a month, maybe it's a year, maybe it's protracted. But eventually, we get to the point where we are back on our feet. Now we have an experience that God can use to help other people. Maybe there's somebody else whose faith is not quite as strong as yours was, that have a similar experience. Maybe let's just say the death of a child. Death of a child is a very hard blow. It's unnatural. It's difficult. Well, here's one that, as difficult and hard as it was, got through it with faith intact. Here's another that lost a child, but their faith was not as strong. And they are leaving the Lord. Who is going to be able to help them better than the elders of the church or the preacher? Somebody who can sit down and cry with them on the couch and say, I've been there. This is how I felt. This is what I leaned on. These are the verses that help me. You see how experience can lead to greater service. And when you think about it, this is true in a large picture sense. You think about all the patriarchs. They all suffered. Abraham, Jacob, Joseph, Moses. They all suffered tremendously before they became the leaders of God's people. So it's true in the big sense that God may need me to do something big, be an elder in the church or be a missionary somewhere or whatever. But it's also true in the smaller sense. How valuable is one person in the church? Worth more than all the world, right? As God esteems it, Matthew 16:26, if by my experience I can help one person go to heaven who would have been lost without me being there, then I have just accomplished something that will be the greatest thing I do in my whole life. So all that I've gone through up to that point to qualify me to help that one person was worth it if God uses me to save a single soul. Now, He may be able to use me to save a lot of souls, but even one would be sufficient. You think about David, 1 Samuel 17:34-37, when he came to visit his brothers and Goliath was in the valley of Elah and he was saying, send someone down to fight me, and all the soldiers were afraid and Saul was afraid and his brothers were afraid. Nobody would go. He'd been doing this for a month or more, and David said, I'll fight him. And that got up to Saul. He came into Saul. Saul, you're a kid. You're a boy. I can't send you down there. He will destroy you and you'll embarrass Israel, and then we will be defeated according to the terms of the contract that he's throwing out every day. And David said, I can do this. Do you remember how he defended his ability to do it? Why he had confidence that he could beat a giant? He said, I kept my father's sheep. That's experience. But that wasn't sufficient experience to fight a giant, was it? But when I kept my father's sheep, a lion and a bear came and stole from the flock. And I went after them, and I killed them. And he references the lion. I don't know that I'd ever really thought about this much before. I remember when we were in Africa in a mission trip years ago, that we went out in more of the bush and visited with some of the Maasai tribe. And part of the ritual of being, I don't know if it's still the case, probably not with the rules against killing animals, but back then, part of the ritual for becoming a warrior in their tribe was to antagonize a lion and get him to charge you. And when he charged, you plant your spear and he impales himself on the spear instead of killing you. I thought then, I wonder how many don't make it to be warriors, you know. That's dangerous. Well, this is what David said he did when he went to get the lamb. I guess the lamb was dead. I don't know, but he wasn't going to get any more lambs from David. And so he went and he said, I caught him by the beard and slew him. Can you imagine? I don't know if he had a spear, a knife, a sword, or a big rock. I don't know how he did it. But he killed a lion with nothing, you know, hand-to-hand combat. Doesn't say how he killed the bear, but he also killed a bear. And then The Lord delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear. The Lord will deliver me from the hand of the giant. See how he reasoned? Well, I was able to reason like that. Experience. Maybe David, on the day he got attacked by the lion, maybe he thought, why did God do this to me? I almost got killed today. A lion attacked me. Why would God let that happen to me? But now looking back from the valley of Elah, you see why God let that happen. It taught him self-confidence. It gave him an ability and experience that he was able to use for the good of God and God's purposes. We'll say it this way, and then I'll illustrate it. We'll have to be finished. But firsthand experience in suffering is essential in equipping for ministry. Firsthand experience in suffering. You can't read about it in a book and be qualified to be a leader. Firsthand experience in suffering is essential in qualification for being a leader. Now, illustrate it. Somebody said, if you want a man whose lips drop down with pearls, look for one who has been in the deep waters. David was a fugitive before he was a king. He suffered before he wrote the Psalms. In fact, most of the Psalms were written out of difficulty, and most of the epistles of the New Testament were written from prison. You see how God used that to bless all generations. Most of the greatest thinkers, the greatest thoughts of the greatest thinkers, the greatest men of the ages, have come under times of duress. Bunyan wrote Pilgrim's Progress from jail. Florence Nightingale was too ill to get out of her bed when she reorganized the hospitals in England. Louis Pasteur was semi-paralyzed as he worked to fight against disease and was ultimately successful. And American historian Francis Parkman suffered so acutely that he was only able to work for 5 minutes at a time. And his eyesight was so poor that he could only scribble a few words on a page. But somehow he was able to write 20 volumes of magnificent history under those circumstances. So chastening makes us better by education and by experience. We will have to stop there, but we will, Lord willing, pick up tonight and talk about how God accomplishes this. You know, how can I recognize if God's chastening me, if God's disciplined me, or not? Sometimes it's not as clear cut. So we'll look at some of the things the Bible says along those lines. And we thank you for your attendance this morning. We'll be dismissed until the worship hour.